This episode comes from my archives. For the most current episodes, please go to germwarfare.com.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. Dr. Anthony Levitino, hope I said that correctly. Thank you for joining That's me great. In the trenches.
Nice to be here, Germ.
The pleasure is all mine. I have, as I said to you a moment ago, I've been wanting to chat to you for a very long time. I stumbled across a video of yours. I think it was in front of the U.S. Congress, which I think went viral. A lot of people watched that, and it was absolutely hair-raising. But before we get to that, just for context, what is your background?
I am now a retired obstetrician gynecologist. I graduated from my residency program in 1980 in upstate New York. Practiced for many years in upstate New York, both private practice, university practice. Then in 2002, my wife and I moved to southern New Mexico, where I worked for another 16 years. Probably my best experience in working was as a faculty at the medical college up in Albany, New York. And it was that time that I was doing a lot of high-risk obstetrics with the whole staff at a tertiary referral center where all these high-risk pregnancies come in New York for almost 10 years. It became an important part of my career. It was very enjoyable. It was very challenging. But also, I found out how much I loved to teach. When we moved to New Mexico, there was no medical school, so that was over. And then we were in the town of Las Cruces, New Mexico. It's the second largest city of New Mexico, but it's only 100,000 people. Several years after we moved there, a gentleman showed up in town, a pediatric anesthesiologist who announced he wanted to build a medical school in Las Cruces. We all thought he was crazy. He raised $72 million and he built a medical school. So I've been on the faculty of that medical school ever since, teaching endocrinology and reproductive medicine to second year students. It's been a great run.
How I came across you was a video. It was a U.S. congressional hearing of some sort, and you gave a little less than a 5-minute talk. You were describing the process of abortion, and it's something I'd never heard before, and I think a lot of others had never heard before.
Well, a lot of people haven't heard it, you know, and it's interesting, even people that are pro-life. Sometimes I swear they think that the doctor just waves his hands and the baby disappears. Well, it just doesn't happen that way. When we were in New York, getting in front of high school students was difficult. You couldn't get into a public school with a bribe. But there was the biggest high school in our area had a senior level civics course. And the gentleman who taught that course was very clever. What he did on the first day of class, he would give the entire class a list of 50 topics: abortion, war, environment, oil exploration, on and on and on and on, crime. And the students could pick 10 topics, and then those are what they discussed during the year. And every single year, abortion was always at the top of the list, always. They always picked it number one. And we weren't debating, but we were able to get into the school and do presentations for the students. Anybody who's given a speech or talk, especially an older person with gray hair, who walks in as a stranger into a high school classroom with 16 and 17-year-olds who know everything and try to make an impression knows how difficult that is. And I would talk to them about abortion and my experiences, and you could just see the body language. It would just bounce off their eyes, fall on the ground, and die. So my wife and I were going to one of these sessions once. We did this for a few years, and I was frustrated. And I said, how do you get through to teenagers? And she's the one who said, describe an abortion for them. See how that goes. So I did. And all of a sudden, the body language, instead of just, yeah, go ahead and press me, was wide-eyed. And you could see like, oh, I got your attention. So I've used that frequently, including at the congressional hearing. It goes like this. I understand a lot of people are, quote, pro-choice. They support the idea of abortion. That's okay. That's what you believe. But at least know what you support. I want you to imagine that you're an obstetrician gynecologist like me. And I want you to imagine that you're a pro-choice obstetrician gynecologist like I used to be. Your patient today is 17 years old. She's 20 weeks pregnant. Her uterus is all the way up to her umbilicus. She's been feeling her baby kick for the last 2 weeks. Now, if you could see her baby, and that's easy on an ultrasound, if just to know what we're talking about, her baby would be the length of your hand, from the tip of your middle finger to your wrist. That's how large a 20-week baby is, not counting the legs. That's head to rump. And like I said, she's been feeling her baby kick for the last 2 weeks. But now she's asleep on an operating room table, and you're there to help her with her problem. You walk into the operating room scrubbed and gowned, and there's a set of instruments on the right. And the first thing you grasp is a suction catheter. This is a 14-friend suction catheter. It's clear plastic. It's about 11 inches long. Picture yourself, if you can, putting this up through the cervix into the uterus and instruct your circulating nurse to turn on the suction machine. And what you'll see is pale yellow fluid running through the tubing and in the machine. That was the amniotic fluid that was there to protect the baby. Now, if she were only 12 weeks pregnant or so, you could pretty much do the entire abortion with this one instrument. A 12-week baby, by comparison, look at your hand again, the width of your hand from head to rump. That's a 12-week fetus. And it's quite easy to tear apart a 12-week fetus or smaller with one of these suction tubes. Babies this big don't fit through catheters this size. So you look at your table and you reach for your Sofer clamps. You don't have to imagine what I've got one here. There we go. I get it on full screen. It's about 13 inches long. It's stainless steel. The business end, if you can see this, is about 2.5 inches long and about 1/2 inch wide. And you can see there's rows of sharp teeth here. This is a grasping instrument. When it gets a hold of something, it absolutely does not let go. A second trimester D&E abortion is a blind procedure the way I used to do. I mean, you can use ultrasound, but frankly, it doesn't help much. It actually just slows things down. So picture yourself putting this up through the cervix. And be careful not to perforate the walls because they're thin and soft. And I've done that, and I can tell you about that later. Grasp anything you can blindly and pull. And feel yourself pulling, and I do mean hard. And out pops a leg about that big, which you put down on the table next to you. Then reach in again. Grasp blindly. Pull hard. Out comes an arm about the same length, which you put down on the table next to you. And you put this instrument in again and again and tear out the spine, the intestines, the heart and lungs. Now, the head on a baby that size is about the size of a plum. Now, you can't see it, but you're pretty sure you've got it if your instrument's around something and your fingers are spread as far as they will go. You know you did it right if you crush down on the instrument and white material runs out of the cervix. That was the baby's brains. Now you can pull out skull pieces. Sometimes the little face comes back and stares back at you. Congratulations, you just successfully performed a second trimester D&E abortion. You just affirmed her right to choose. You just made $800 cash in 15 minutes. Now, I've told that story many times. And in 1983, 1984, in that age range at that time, I was making $800 cash doing one of those procedures. And you could do that procedure in about 15 minutes. There's prep time and all this other stuff that goes in there, but the actual procedure was about 15 minutes. That $800 cash that I was collecting in 1984 is the equivalent of $2,300 today in 15 minutes. Now, interestingly, the price of second trimester D&E abortions is still around $800 or $900, which means inflation has eaten away at it over all that time. But that's a hell of a lot of money to make in 15 minutes.
The hair on my arms is standing up at the moment. I'm not quite sure how to respond, but that is an unbelievable visual. What you've just described is the brutal killing of a little baby, really.
That's true. And this is a non-viable child. This is 20 weeks from the last menstrual period. Pregnancy lasts 40 weeks. So this is a child halfway through the pregnancy. Now, children are viable, capable of living outside the womb with proper medical care, starting at about 22 weeks. And there's a little argument, it's 22 or 23, but it's about that. World Health Organization and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists acknowledges viability now as about 22 weeks. So this is not a viable baby, but this is a fully formed, actively moving child. And that is what the procedure is. I gave the first lecture ever on abortion at my medical college last year, and I made a statement. And of course, as a professor, I'm not an advocate. I'm there to take a neutral stance and teach students of all persuasions. And I think I did pretty good at that. But I did make the statement that in every abortion, a human life is destroyed. One of the students complained to the administration, and I got called. And I was discussing this with the gentleman who handles these things, who is himself a physician. And he said, well, you know, the student says, you know, you said this, you know, this is your opinion. And I couldn't believe he said this. I said, you are a doctor. You are a scientist. Is this a human being or not? And of course, he said, yes. I said, Is it dead at the end of the procedure? Yes. Then, it's not my opinion, a human life is destroyed every time an abortion is done. I get troubled by, yes, you're saying baby. That's prejudice. That's a biased term. You should use the term fetus. Well, fetus is a totally appropriate and correct scientific term. But the way you're using it is to dehumanize that human being. So I use a different term, but we'll get to that.
Okay, so this is a very heated conversation. And because my wife's pregnant, this is obviously very dear to me. And I can tell you right now, that is my child that is inside of her. That is a baby, you know, and there's no question in my mind whatsoever. But I often hear people, like you just pointed out, play with the term fetus and baby, and also termination rather than abortion. Is there a difference?
Well, you know as well as I do. I urge my students, many of them are, of course, they're all considerably younger than me, but a lot of them haven't gotten much of a classical education over the years. And I urge them all to read the novel 1984. I think you've got to read this. And then look around, folks, look around. You and I both know if you control the language, you control the thinking. So I get frustrated by that too. Almost never will they use the term abortion. It's reproductive rights. It's reproductive freedom. It's termination. This is the reality of it. And when you force people to face that reality, it's interesting because most people don't even think about it. Like I said, even pro-life people, they think the doctor waves his hands and the baby disappears. Doesn't happen, folks.
There are different time periods when this is considered legal. There's a whole big thing around when does life start or human life start, when does the heartbeat, etc. What is your opinion on that?
I think that there's plenty of scientific information out there for people to look up. A human heart is beating 28 days after conception. I have, my wife and I started a pregnancy assistance center in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I was doing all the ultrasounds at the beginning as the people were getting trained. And I have a recording, I still have it, of an ultrasound taken at 29 days from conception with twins, two sacs, and you can see the heart beating in both. These are scientific facts. So the heart is beating at 28 days after conception, and the baby moves at so many weeks after conception, and the baby has fingerprints. It's, you know, all these things trying to impress on the humanity of this individual organism. But you know what? It's not very persuasive to the other side. And I know people will object to this, but I've been doing this a long time. You can put scientific facts about fetuses, baby, pick your term, in front of people all day long. But if they believe in abortion, they don't care. Doesn't matter. It's my choice. It's my choice. It's my choice. It's interesting about the whole choice thing. Quick story. Before I moved from to New Mexico, I was working in an office. Interesting. Husband-wife team, both gynecologists. She was doing general gynecology on the first floor of the building. That's where I worked with her. Her husband did in vitro fertilization. He was an infertility expert on the second floor. So he had a big lab set up and everything else to accomplish that work. He used to train residents as well. And we were sitting at lunch. We all used to eat lunch together. And one of the residents, Peter and I were sitting with the resident. We were discussing the possible connection between abortion and breast cancer. And I looked at the student. I said, you're a resident. You're a doctor. Here are the papers. Read them. Make up your own mind. Here's the data. I didn't know, but one of the embryologists who work in the lab was listening to the conversation. She came down at the end of the day, and this lady's a scientist herself. She's an embryologist. She works in the lab. And she said, you know, I was really interested by that discussion. Could I have copies of those papers, too? I said, absolutely no problem. We got talking about the issue, and you don't have to go very long, again, the language thing, to start getting an idea where somebody falls on this from the language they're picking. And I could kind of tell she was in that direction. And I had never spoken with this lady extensively. I knew her first name. I knew that she was 26 years old, and I knew that she'd been married for 6 months. That's all I knew about her. So I asked her, I said, so what do you think of the abortion issue? And she gave a very typical mushy, relativistic moral answer, I would call it. She said, well, you know, I feel kind of bad about it, but it's just a choice. And I had this flash, and I looked at her, as I said, that's all I knew about her. And I said, so what you're telling me is that if your husband cheated on you, you'd be perfectly okay with that, because after all, that's just a choice. she went boom, just like that, in a split second, because now it was emotional and it meant something to her. Oh, that would be wrong. Oof. We went from moral relativism, what's right for right is for me, and what's right for you is right for you, to absolute right and wrong in the blink of an eye. And I said, well, why is it wrong? He promised. I said, I agree with you, it would be wrong because he promised. But is it wrong just because he promised, or is it wrong because it's wrong? It's wrong because it's wrong. Oh, okay, interesting. Then I asked her a few other questions. How do you feel about abortion in cases where a couple does absolutely nothing to prevent a pregnancy? Oh, I don't like that. Oh, okay. How do you feel about sex selection abortion? I don't want girls, I only want boys. Oh, that's wrong. I only asked her a few more questions, and she was the one who looked at me and said, I guess I'm more pro-life than I thought. Yeah, maybe you are.
Something that I've never quite understood is the my body, my choice argument. It's not your body. It's a separate being with its own DNA.
Well, this is something we teach the medical students. There are principles of ethics. How do you decide that something's ethical or is not? You know, there are principles that have been laid down in terms of classic ethics. And one of those is personal autonomy. I have the right as a patient to decide what treatment I do or do not receive. Personal autonomy is very important, but there are other principles of ethics as well. Beneficence, do good things. Non-malfeasance, don't do bad things. Then there's autonomy, I have a right to determine my treatment. And then there's justice. And in the United States, I point to probably the best statement of justice is in our Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So autonomy is an important principle. You can't just disregard it. But the point is, you know, my body, my choice implies that the right to autonomy is unlimited. It's not. So I'll tell them, okay, so our medical school is right next to a major highway. I said, can you get on I-25 and drive 100 miles an hour? Well, no. Well, why not? Your body, your choice. It doesn't take them long to figure out, well, they don't let me drive 100 miles an hour because I might hurt someone else. Oh, then your autonomy has limits if it injures another individual. So the point is, yes, autonomy is an important ethical principle, but it's not the only one. And you can't throw out the other three just because you like the one to make your argument.
Dr. Leventino, you, if I'm correct, performed over 1,000 abortions. What led to the change of heart?
When I graduated from medical school, I was in 1976, I was dedicated. If you asked me, I was absolutely pro-choice. There was a decision between a woman, her doctor, and nobody, including the baby's father, had anything to say about it. And most people are shocked to hear, but legally, fathers have no say at all. But that's how I felt. And as part of my training, I learned to do first and second trimester abortions, and then I did them in my practice. Over a period of 4 years, I did over 1,200 abortions, including over 120 late-term abortions up to 24 weeks of gestation. I said 20 weeks was the length of your hand. Add another 2 centimeters or so, and that's 24 weeks. And I was doing them up to that level, and I was quite dedicated to it. In my first year of training, I met my wife at the hospital. We dated and married. And like a lot of young couples, we wanted to have kids. We were in our late 20s at the time. We thought we were so old. I'm 71 now. Found out pretty quickly we had an infertility problem. She just wasn't getting pregnant. I sent her to the best infertility expert in town. Any woman who's been through an infertility workup knows that it is difficult, painful, embarrassing. And after a rather extensive workup, she would go to those visits, including having surgery, and come home. Let me back up a little bit. When we first started dating, we found out we were on opposite sides of the issue. I'm doing abortion, she's pro-life. That had its own problems, but we won't go there. But she would come home from those visits, lock herself in the bathroom and cry. Here she is trying desperately to get pregnant, and two ironies were not lost on her. One, here she is married to an OBGYN and she can't get pregnant. Two, here she is trying to get pregnant and her husband's doing abortions, killing the kids as part of his work. But that idea, you know, like I said, was a clash of ideas, and she pushed that out of her head as fast as possible. We were told that there was one more procedure they could try. It should take about an hour and a half. It was decades ago, but I remember vividly the color of the paint, the room, the doctor, everything. When he walked up to me after 4.5 hours in the operating room, he told me, I said, look, I never tell anyone that they can't have a baby, but don't count on it. We were devastated. So after we got over the shock, we tried to adopt a child. And anyone who's tried to adopt a child knows how difficult that is. We went to religious agencies, state agencies, county agencies, anywhere we could. And the best we could do after months of effort was get on a 5-year waiting list to get on the waiting list. And it was during that time when that I had my first doubts about doing abortions. As I said, I was dedicated, but I'm not an idiot. The reason there are no babies to adopt is guys like me killing them. I remember even a very specific abortion, just a 12-week suction DNC, and thinking, gosh, I'm throwing these kids into garbage. Wouldn't even one of these women allow us to take her child home and care for our own? But of course, it doesn't work that way. After a lot of frustration, I came up with what my wife still credits as the best idea I've ever come up with in our entire relationship, except for me asking her to marry me. And that was, I said, you know, this is crazy. We're getting absolutely nowhere in the normal channels. I know 50 obstetricians on a first name basis. Let's advertise. Maybe we'll get lucky. And that's what we did. We let people know we were looking for a baby to adopt, hoping that some kid would fall between the cracks and be available for a private adoption. Well, months after starting that in August of 1978, I was working in the operating room with an attending physician. And the circulating nurse tapped me on the shoulder and I turned around because you can't touch anything but the patient. And she was holding up a piece of paper and said, call Marcia as soon as you're done. Marcia was the head of social services at the hospital, the medical center. She's one of the people we talked to. That's all the message said, but I knew what it meant. And sure enough, she informed me there was a 15-year-old girl in labor in the delivery room. She had no prenatal care. First time she saw a doctor was the day before. But now she's in labor. She's healthy. The baby looks healthy. She wants to give her baby up for adoption. Are you interested? Of course I was interested. I remember staring at the face of the telephone and knowing I was just 7 digits away from becoming a father by calling my wife with this news. And we were blessed to be able to adopt a little girl that we named Heather in August of 1978. Fantastic. We have a baby. And after all the years and after all the tears and after all the doubts, we had a baby of our own. And my wife got pregnant the very next month. And our son Sean was born in July 1979. Now, Sean and Heather were figuratively and literally close. They were only 10 months apart. Anybody who didn't know Heather had been adopted would look at the two of them and go, 10 months apart? Man, you didn't give your wife much of a break, did you? But hey, I've got the proverbial millionaire's family. I've got a son and a daughter now. And any doubts I had about doing abortions simply evaporated. And I went back to business as usual. Several years later, on June 23rd, 1984, she was exactly 2 months away from her 6th birthday. Sean was just a few days away from his 5th birthday. She was killed in an auto accident that day. We were home. We had some friends visiting. The kids had been playing in the backyard. And we were talking with our friends, and we heard the screech of brakes out in front of the house and found out that Heather had been hit by a car. And she literally died in our arms in a vacuum ambulance. Now, if you have kids, or anybody who's listening who has kids, you may think you have some idea of what that feels like. If you haven't been through this yourself, you have no idea. I hope you never find out. But what do you do after a disaster? You bury your child, you take some time off, and then you try to get back in your life. And I don't know how long it was after Heather's death. It was a few weeks. But I showed up at OR number 9 at Albany Medical Center in Albany, New York, to do a second trimester D&E abortion. It was nothing special. It was routine. I had other things on my mind. And I started that abortion, and I reached in with that sofa clamp, and I ripped out an arm or a leg, and I got sick. But, you know, when you start an abortion, you can't stop. Earlier, I talked about stacking up body parts on the side of the table. That's not to gross out the people that are watching the show. When you do an abortion, you have to keep inventory. You have to make sure that you get 2 arms, 2 legs, and all the pieces. Because if you don't, your patient will come back infected, bleeding, or dead. So I finished that abortion, and I know it sounds strange to people, but I promise you everything I'm telling you is firsthand and true. For the first time in my career, after all those years and all those abortions, I really looked at that pile of body parts on the side of the table, and I didn't see her wonderful right to choose, and I didn't see what a great doctor I was helping her with her problem, and I didn't even see the $800 cash I just made in 15 minutes. All I could see was somebody's son or daughter. And it occurred to me in that moment that this patient had come to me, figuratively, never literally, looked at me and said, here's $800, kill my son or daughter. And I was the kind of person that would look her straight in the eye with no compunction whatsoever, say, sure, I'll do that. That was the beginning of the end. And it was several months after that. I didn't stop right away, but it was several months after that that I stopped doing abortions entirely. I talked to you earlier. We talked, oh, baby. Oh, that's a biased term. It's a fetus. Yes, it is. But the way you're using fetus is as a dehumanizing term. Those weren't Germans we killed in World War II. They were Krauts. You know, this kind of thing we do all the time. So I will use the term baby. I sometimes use the term fetus. You've heard me do it today. But more often than not, I use the term that is absolutely 100% correct in every pregnancy and in every stage of pregnancy. That's your son or daughter.
Is there ever a time, in your opinion, when abortion is okay?
I understand the whole thing about bodily autonomy, but in the end, you're paying somebody to kill your son or daughter. I've got a serious, I have a serious moral problem with that. There is a movement now, and especially medical abortion is a big deal, and we need to talk about that because that's really what abortion is. We can talk about all these surgical abortions, but now the game is medical abortion. We can get into that if you want.
Yeah, what is that, by the way?
But we'll get there in a minute.
Okay.
But let me answer your last question. There is a movement now, and I haven't seen this before, conflating treatment of miscarriage and treatment of ectopic pregnancies with abortion, which it is not. It is not the same thing. But I use the example from my medical students. I've had this happen in real practice. Somebody comes in with pain. They have a positive pregnancy test. I do an ultrasound, and I find she has an ectopic pregnancy. Her pregnancy is not in the uterus where it's supposed to be. It's in the fallopian tube. Let's imagine, hypothesize, I see an intact gestational sac with a fetus and an active heart beating in the fallopian tube. What would I do as a pro-life physician? Answer, I would take that pregnancy out because it's going to kill her. Okay? There are other situations where abortion procedures are totally justified on medical and ethical grounds. I can go into specifics, but there's a handful of rare conditions. Now, the other thing that's happening these days are people are talking about, right now in Arizona, I live in the state of Arizona. Abortion is legal up to 15 weeks in the state of Arizona. There's a constitutional initiative for our state constitution going on the ballot in November to make basically legalize abortion at any time during pregnancy, right up to birth. They'll deny that's what it is, but that's what it says. It doesn't say that expressly, but if you understand the legal language, and I'm a lawyer too, that's what it says. They're counting that, well, we have to have late-term abortion to save women's lives. Look, pregnancy can be dangerous. There are many pregnancy conditions that can seriously injure the mother or kill a mother. I told you that I spent almost 10 years working in a tertiary referral center in upstate New York, treating people with these kind of conditions. Out of control blood pressure, preeclampsia, toxemia, out of control diabetes, decompensating cardiac function, cancers. These are horrible situations. And frequently, the only way we can treat the situation is by terminating, except I hate using that term because they've stolen it, ending the pregnancy. Now, I'll give you a perfect example, real case. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm on call at the hospital. The senior resident calls me. I go in to see a patient. She is 28 weeks pregnant. She has severe preeclampsia. Most people know that a normal blood pressure is 120 over 80. Her blood pressure was 220 over 160 with a severe headache. This lady has severe preeclampsia. She could seize at any minute, and she could end up in serious, serious trouble. The only treatment for preeclampsia, severe preeclampsia, is deliver the patient. So we stabilized her and we did a cesarean section. Within an hour, the baby was out getting care. And mom, once the pregnancy's out, then her preeclampsia starts to subside. Mom and baby did fine. Now, it's kicker. The funny thing about that story is that was 28 years ago. That young lady is 28 years old. I spoke to her just yesterday. She calls me every now and then to say hello, let me know what's going on with her. That's a typical situation. And I tell people, in my career as a pro-life obstetrician gynecologist, I terminated, ended hundreds of pregnancies to save women's lives. Now, during that time, Germ, you tell me, how many babies in almost 10 years of doing that work, hundreds of cases, how many babies did I have to deliberately kill in the process? Not even one. Did every one of those kids make it? No. Many of them were severely premature, and we do the best we can. But many of them did survive, just like this young lady that I talked to on the phone just yesterday. Now, we need late-term abortion to save women's lives. Okay, but there's a problem with that. And that is, let's take that same case. Let's say that that mother, hypothetically, has said, you know what, you've got to end my pregnancy anyway. I've been thinking about this. I can't raise a child right now. I want you to do an abortion instead. Could we have used a late-term abortion to save her life in that instance? Answer, no. Why? Because a late-term abortion takes too long to do. You can't just do it like that. You have to prepare the cervix. You have to go through a lot of steps. In the United States, you have to kill the baby first before you do an abortion. Otherwise, if that's a live human being that's been born, whoa, that's now a person protected under a law. And if you kill that child then, it's murder. That's why Dr. Gosnell, if you've heard his name, is spending the rest of his life in jail where he belongs. It takes anywhere from 3 to 7 days to accomplish a late-term abortion, all told. If you have a real emergency, I mean a true emergency, a cardiac function is decompensating, her blood pressure is 220 over 160, I could go through a million other things. You don't have 3 to 7 days to fix the problem. You've got to do it now. And that's why, as I said, as a pro-life obstetrician, I saved hundreds of women by terminating their pregnancies. But I used a process that we call delivery. Late-term abortion, except for very rare circumstances, there are a few circumstances where you need it, but except in very rare circumstances, is useless for saving women's lives. It takes too long.
You said you would explain to me what the term medical abortion means.
The new thing now is abortion with pills. In the United States, you can get an abortion pill regimen that can be used up to 10 weeks from the last menstrual period. It's a two-drug regimen. The first drug is called Mifeprex, or Mifepristone is its chemical name. It used to be called RU486. Some people are still familiar with that older term. And what it does is it progesterone is a natural hormone that that keeps the pregnancy intact inside the uterus. That's what keeps the lining of the uterus healthy that nourishes the baby. Mifepristone interferes with progesterone. The endometrial lining that's supporting the baby breaks down and the baby dies. And then you give a second drug called Cytotec or misoprostol. Interestingly, the drug was approved originally for treatment of ulcers. Turns out to work really well at inducing labor. You take that 24 to 48 hours after the first drug, and that induces uterine contractions to expel the dead baby. That's the drug regimen. It works. It's effective. What's the advantage of a medical abortion? Well, you don't have to be a trained obstetrician gynecologist. You don't have to know how to do D&Cs. The only skill you need is to write a prescription. Yeah, but what if you get complications? Then what? Even the FDA, Food and Drug Administration in the United States, will tell you the average amount of bleeding that women get with these pills is 9 to 16 days long. Can be heavy. A significant percentage of patients bleed for a month or more. There is anywhere from, and looking at the scientific research, anywhere from 2 to 8% of these cases, especially as you get bigger, will end up in an emergency room and will need a suction D&C anyway, or treatment for an infection or some other significant complication. One of the draws of a medical, but what's private? I don't have to go to the doctor's office. They could just, I can get my prescription. I can do this in the privacy of my home. Yeah. Now, if you want to induce a miscarriage at home, anybody who hasn't seen the movie Unplanned should watch that movie. Abby Johnson, who left Planned Parenthood, had a medical abortion. And in that movie, they portray her experience of what it's like to go through one of these medical or chemical abortions. It's pretty horrific. And on the subject of privacy, and I told this to my students, if you want an abortion to be private, have a suction DNC. It has lower complication rate. It's over in 10 minutes. Bleeding tends to be light to minimal. And you can start contraception at the same time. It costs the same. Why would anybody want to take pills when they could do a suction DNC? Now, you might say, well, there are some locations where there aren't as many people doing these. True. But if you're one of that 2 to 8% that needs an emergency room, who's going to take care of the complications? And this is the major problem with this. Okay, you got a doctor who says he's an abortionist, and they have the skill to do a suction DNC, a surgical abortion, but they like giving out the pills too for those patients who want it. Fine. And if she has a problem, she calls her doctor and says, geez, I'm having heavy bleeding, severe pain, something else. And the doctor would say, well, I'll meet you at the emergency room and we'll take care of you. I've got no problem with that on a strictly medical care basis. Okay. But when you've got somebody, say a family practitioner or a nurse practitioner or a midwife writes a prescription for this drug, but doesn't have the skill to do a suction DNC and the patient has problems, what happens? When they call at 2 o'clock in the morning, what are they told? Go to the emergency room. These patients are being dumped, and that's the term dumped, into emergency rooms. And the abortionists usually won't even call the emergency room and tell them what the hell is going on. This is unethical. It's just no one should be initiating a medical procedure if they don't have the skill to take care of complications that can occur from that procedure. It's another problem too. And you're seeing this in other ways. Non-physicians are now writing prescriptions for abortion pills who don't have the skill to take care of the problems. If you look on the internet, there are numerous websites where you can go to, and they will do a video conference with you, just like you and I are doing, right? And I would tell you, oh, my last period was 6 weeks ago, and I don't want to be pregnant. And you ask me a few questions, and then you mail me a prescription for the pill, possibly across state lines, okay? Then, again, when you have a complication at 2 a.m., who the hell do you call? They live in another state. They're nowhere near you. Then once again, it's go to the emergency room, more emergency room dumping. And there's another problem too. There are potential safety aspects to this that are being ignored. The known rate, we talked about ectopic pregnancies, pregnancy in a tube. Ectopic pregnancy can kill you. And people can and have died who've taken abortion pills thinking they had a normal pregnancy who actually had a tubal or ectopic pregnancy. Again, the FDA requirements for use of the abortion pill, one, the practitioner must be able to accurately determine the length of gestation. It's only approved up to 10 weeks. When was your last period? Okay, that's usually right, but 40% of the time that does not give you an accurate dating. You need to talk to a patient, physically examine the patient, and do an ultrasound if necessary to determine gestational age accurately. You can't do that on a video chat. You must, according to the FDA, be able to diagnose and rule out ectopic pregnancy, because the use of abortion pill in an ectopic pregnancy, and we're talking upwards of 1.5 to 2% of all pregnancies are ectopic. You must be able to rule out an ectopic pregnancy. How do you do that? In the real world, you do an exam on the patient. And if you're not sure what you're feeling, you get an ultrasound, and then you know where the pregnancy is. How do you do that on a video chat? You can't. There are other problems. I don't want to get too technical, but there are other safety issues involved with that. This is horrendous. There was a study. The point of the study was to show the absolute safety of just using pills for abortion. And the paper was fascinating because our National Academy of Science put out a publication several years ago about how safe abortion is. And they highlighted this paper. It's called the Ireland paper, not because it was done in Ireland, but because one of the authors was named Ireland. They had done 1,600 abortions. In the abstract of the paper at the beginning, it boldly states, medical abortion is 99.6% effective. Whoa! In the same paragraph, it said that 2.1% of their patients ended up in emergency rooms and needed surgery. So how is it that it can be 99.6% if over 2% of your patients showed up in an emergency room? Somehow they missed that. And they also wanted to impress us with the extremely low rate of ectopic pregnancy. Their rate of ectopic pregnancy was only 0.007%. And they still managed to kill one of their patients with an ectopic pregnancy. That's the problem with pill abortions and getting them over the internet.
Other than the mental issues, I'm guessing arise from women choosing to abort, what are the actual potential medical issues or biological issues that can arise from aborting?
There are always risks. Every medical procedure has risk. That's all there is to it. And in surgical abortion, there's a risk of bleeding, infection, perforating the uterus. I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. If you perforate the uterus with one of the instruments, you could damage the intestine, bladder, other structures or blood vessels above the uterus. So there are always risks involved in abortions. With chemical abortion, there's a risk of heavy, uncontrolled bleeding that may require surgery to stop. Incomplete abortion, leaving pieces behind, the risk of trying to abort an ectopic pregnancy we've already talked about with pills that doesn't work. Perforation is a really interesting one. I was doing one of those late-term D&E abortions many years ago, and there's all these papers about, oh, these are so safe, you can do them in outpatient clinics. My partners and I, we had our own rules, and it was you do not do something that big outside of a hospital. So we used to do them all in the hospital. And a day came when I was doing one of these late-term abortions, and I reached in with that sofa clamp like I was talking about, and I reached in and pulled, but instead of pulling out an arm or a leg, what I had in my clamp was the lady's intestines. The clamp had gone through the wall. I grabbed the intestine, pulled it, and I pulled her small intestine through the uterus, through her vagina, and all the way to the outside before I realized that's what I had. Oh, it's not safe. You can do them anywhere. Really? This patient was anesthetized in a sterile environment in a hospital, and all I had to do was call the front desk and say, hey, send doctor one of the, are any of the surgeons out there? Yeah, so-and-so's available. Send him in here right now. And we took care of the problem, and she was fine. How the hell are you going to do if something like that happens in your outpatient clinic or a Planned Parenthood? You know what they're going to do. They're going to call an ambulance. They're going to send them to the hospital, and one more time, they're going to dump the patient into the hospital. I collected money for this procedure and I created a problem. Now you fix it. This is unethical. Mm-hmm. And that's one example of that. You asked about mental stuff. There are a lot of stresses involved. Don't ever, ever, ever talk about an abortion of convenience. There's nothing convenient about an unwanted pregnancy, and there sure as hell nothing convenient about an abortion. So I think that is insensitive and not something that should be, she said. There are tremendous stresses on these young women, if they're young or otherwise, but there are tremendous stresses on these women. I'm worried about my future. I'm worried about my education. I'm worried about my finances. I don't want daddy to know I've been screwing Johnny. You know, they're under a lot of stress. And you will hear this all the time when we talk about mental concerns that come with abortion. And the abortionists will say, oh, that's just crap. The only emotion we ever see on our patients is relief. They are not lying. When a woman goes through an abortion, she's under all that stress. And then when the abortion's over, the pressure's off. Okay, she doesn't have to worry about those things. And I will tell you as a former abortionist that yes, the first emotion you see is relief. That's absolutely true. But then the abortionist never sees her again. Me, I was running a practice. We weren't running an abortion clinic. It was just part of our regular practice. So many of these, some of these were referrals, and I didn't see them again, but many of these patients I saw for years afterwards because they were my patients. There's an assumption, I think for many patients, there's an assumption being made. It's not my time to have a baby right now for whatever reason. I will do this abortion, but I can always get pregnant later. Well, sometimes that doesn't happen for any number of reasons. I had one patient in particular. She was in her mid-20s. She was pregnant. It wasn't the right time. She asked me to do an abortion. I did it for her. Her name was Marianne. She was my patient for years and years after that. Within 6 months after that abortion, she got diagnosed with endometriosis. This is a very painful disease that causes infertility. She probably had it beginning at the time she was pregnant, but we didn't know it. There were no symptoms. And the best cure for endometriosis, interestingly, is to go through a pregnancy. Well, once you get the endometriosis, one of the big problems is you can't get pregnant. This woman tried and tried and tried for the next 15 years to get pregnant, and she never did. And every time she came to my office, she cried because she realized that, at least in her case, she had very likely thrown away her only opportunity to have a child. So there's a lot of issues involved, and don't ever think this isn't a stress on patients, because it is.
Dr. Livatino, I do wonder, we talk a lot about definitions and terminology and timing and all that sort of thing, and I feel as if we're playing on the peripheral. I read a statistic that about 1 million abortions a year happen just in the United States. How did this happen?
Well, first off, the numbers are doo-doo. Nobody knows how many abortions actually occur in the United States or anywhere else for that matter. Abortion statistics are, and there's no mandatory reporting of abortion statistics in the United States. The reality is that probably far more abortions are being done than we're being told. I did 1,200 abortions, I told you. I was required by law to file fetal death certificates in New York. I only filed them on the ones I did in the hospital. So only about 120 of them got their fetal death certificates filed. We never bothered with the ones in the office. So almost 1,000 abortions that I did were never officially recorded over the years. So that tells you how inaccurate those studies are. We have changed a lot as a society. Society, everything's always changing. And we have become a more open and permissive society. And there's a lot more sexual activity, I'm guessing, than there's been in the past, or at least it's not hidden like it was in the past. And that results in a lot of unintended pregnancies, a lot of sexually transmitted diseases. A lot of other things come as a result of that behavior. There's a callousness to society, and I know it's not just in the United States. In the language that's being used as we interact with each other, the interactions of children with teachers in school, a tremendous amount of disrespect. None of this stuff happened. Again, I'm old enough, I remember another time when that just wasn't the case. So, you know, to answer your question, I guess the answer is society changed. And in some ways, not for the better.
You mentioned a moment ago the sigh of relief that a lot of the women went through once the abortion was completed. But I was meaning to ask you, what about regret? Did you experience some of that from the woman?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't follow up with the point. Yes, the first emotion they expressed was relief. But it's after that, you go home, it's quiet, it's over. And then you get to think, you know, when your baby was going to be born. And many women, not all, but many women do experience regret, but they suffer mostly in silence. They get ignored. But women aren't stupid. They know when their baby would have been born. It could be years later, and they're walking down and they see a 2-year-old in the grocery store, and the thought can occur, gosh, my son or daughter would be 2 years old right now. Yes, there many patients end up with regret. I had the experience once. I walked into my office many, many years ago, and the secretary calls. She says, "There's a lady on the phone that wants to talk to you." She had seen me on some TV program. She wasn't even my patient. She lived in Connecticut. She wasn't even in the same state. And I got on the phone and I said, "Can I help you?" And the lady broke down in tears and started crying about an abortion that she had had 25 years before. Had never talked about it with anyone, was carrying this all this time. And she just emotionally poured out to me, a total stranger on the phone, about the regrets and hurt that she'd been carrying for all those years about an abortion she had. Not every patient reacts this way, but a lot of patients do. They're not stupid. They know what happened.
And in your experience, were most of the abortions by women who were not married?
That was across the board. I'd say most of them probably were unmarried women, but I didn't keep total, statistics on it. But they were married women, young women, older women. They're all over the map. They're your neighbors. They're the people you see in the grocery store. They're the people you're sitting next to in church. I wrote an article recently trying to oppose this abortion amendment in Arizona, and I told the true story about a young lady that I saw. She was 17 years old. She came in for her fifth abortion, and she made very clear that the reason that she wanted her fifth abortion because she didn't want to be pregnant for her senior prom. And I wrote that in the article, and people, I mean, you see the hate email I got. Oh, you made that story up. That's not true. Yeah, it is. I'm not saying that every woman has abortions for something that trivial, but in this case, she did. And for this 17-year-old, it appears this was her method of birth control because this was her fifth abortion at only age 17.
In your opinion, how damaging have lobby groups like Planned Parenthood and similar been?
Well, Planned Parenthood has been around since 1916. I used to work with Planned Parenthood. I mean, we do pelvic exams, we do pap smears, we do STD screenings, but abortion has become a very major part of the Planned Parenthood business. I never did abortions for Planned Parenthood when I was working with them, but it's a very, very, very big part of what they are. And apparently now, Planned Parenthood is getting very heavy into the gender-affirming surgery and medication business. I don't know what the hell that has to do with Planned Parenthood, but apparently that's a new direction for them. What can I tell you?
I want to ask you something that has often come up in my own circles, and I'm sure you will know exactly what I'm referring to when I say that, yeah, but you're a man. You don't really have a say, or the father has no say.
It's true. Legally, a father has absolutely, at least in the States, has absolutely no say on what happens to his son or daughter. That's his son or daughter, too. And the men, there are a lot of men that are suffering as a result of that, especially because of that helplessness of not having been able to do anything. Abortion affects that child, that human being. It affects mom. It affects dad. It affects the grandparents. It affects the other relatives. And you can make a good argument that in its own way, it affects the whole world. I know that some people would scoff at a statement like that, but it's absolutely true. It takes an awareness of it, and that's why I do what I do, because I want to make people as aware of, you want to support abortion? Okay, that's your right. At least know what you're supporting. And when I tell you a story, trust me, it's all, in my case, I did them. And I was as dedicated as you were once upon a time. But everything I tell you is firsthand and true. And that's the reality of it.
If I'm being honest, I'm quite happy that I myself was not aborted.
Well, me too. But then again, A, they weren't available at the time. And B, I did apparently almost die in childbirth. When I was a medical student, I was doing a rotation at the hospital in Rochester where I'd been born. And I went down to medical records and they were able to dig out those old records of my birth. It's interesting. I'm lucky to be here, but for different reasons. I suppose we all are. And it's the last thing I'll say. You know, people ask, well, you know, if somebody comes to you wants an abortion, what do you tell them? And I know, again, we've talked about she's being driven by tremendous pressures that we talked about before. And you must never lose sight of those things and the pressures that she's under. But I try to explain to some people, and there are a lot of kids alive today because of it, I can tell you from personal experience. But share with that woman in her time of difficulty and stress and confusion that no matter what your situation is, no matter what your education level, no matter what your income is, no matter what your family life is like, no matter what's going on in your life, you and only you can give your son or daughter the one thing that no one else can give them, a chance to live. That's all I'll say about it.
I was going to ask you for something positive, uplifting, but I think that was it. I mean, it's a remarkably dark conversation.
It is, but it's an important one. And I think that people need to understand a little more. It's like in my state, 15 weeks isn't a good enough limit. You got to go all the way to birth. Why? It goes way too far, but that's a subject for another day.
Is there a way that I can follow your commentary, your work, any books, anything like that?
You know, people ask us, no, I haven't written any books. And no. My wife and I chuckle because if you go to YouTube, for instance, actually, just for giggles, go to YouTube, put in my last name, Levatino, Levatino. And you'll find a bunch of stuff come out. We always laugh when people go, oh, I love what you put on the internet. My wife and I have never put a word on the internet. And I stay away from social media because that stuff sticks to you like the tar baby. On the other hand, if you want to see me give a presentation in a secular setting at a college, it's different. Go through the list and look for Virginia Tech. It's a really interesting hour discussion with college students. Little different kind of presentation because we go into the legal side, some of the ethics. And one of the students tries to challenge me. And it's, I always have, I mean, I'm an obstetrician gynecologist. I've been in business over 30 years. I did over 1,200 abortions. And I always chuckle when students think they've got the killer question that's going to stump me. And it's like, come on, I've heard it all. So if you want to be entertained sometime, go to YouTube and watch that video. It's kind of interesting.
Dr. Anthony Levatino, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
You're very welcome.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.